Welcome to the Bacubby Croncast. It is Friday, January 22nd. I'm Brian Murphy.
I'm Doug Brazzoni.
And we have a very special guest this week. It's Wendy Thurm, the internet's own baseball extraordinaire. You've seen her work on the New York Times, Sports on Earth, SB Nation. She's all over the place. She's all over Twitter. And now she's all over this Croncast. Wendy, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
First things first. I mean, the big story here for me is that you are in the New York Times, the paper of record. As Doug reminded me, like, that is what we should be focusing on. How did that come about? You wrote about the Hall of Fame, like the worst possible thing to write about for baseball, and you knocked it out of the park. If you haven't seen our article, it's a great article about who should be in the Hall of Fame, which is basically all the great players should be.
Yeah, the editor for, they have this column, I think it's mostly online, called Room for Debate. I think it's sometimes in print, where they get quote-unquote experts from a particular field to debate, you know, a topic of the day. And the editor contacted me. I'm not exactly sure how he found me, through Twitter or through a personal recommendation, and asked me if I would participate and, you know, would I be comfortable arguing for the everybody in position? I said, well, I'd rather just argue for Bonds and Clemens, and I really would rather not argue for Pete Rose. And he said, oh, well, that, the pro Bonds and Clemens and the not Pete Rose position has been claimed by different quote experts. So I said, okay, well, I'm a former lawyer, so I could pretty much argue anything, whether I have conviction or not. So that's how it happened. And I'm not thrilled that I'm in the New York Times for the first time, you know, talking about, oh, just let Pete Rose in the Hall of Fame. But, you know, that's just the way the dice rolled that time. So yeah, that's how that happened.
Well, I very much enjoyed the article. Maybe because I don't know. I try to avoid all the Hall of Fame stuff now. So the fact that I just didn't really have a lot of, first of all, you won out because you were one of the few articles I read, but also just, it was just very clean, and it made the case very simply without really dragging in. It didn't make a big deal either way of the point that you were making. So maybe kind of like a dispassionate attorney would perhaps present the case. And so I appreciated that. But also, yeah, I did look at the Pete Rose part and I went, oh, okay, I guess she needs that for her bigger argument. And now I know the story behind it. So that's
yes. Yes. And then, and I was thinking, you know, he didn't tell me who the other quote experts were. And I was thinking, oh, it'll be interesting to see who else is on this page with me. And I had never heard of any of the other three people. And so I felt, like, you guys knew who I was, and, you know, I got a lot of play in the family and stuff, but I was like, okay, so this guy thinks I'm an expert, but I've never heard of these other three people. So much for that.
Well, we went to high school with them, and he knows them to be experts.
Exactly. So.
I appreciate in that article, the guy who said, let in Pete Rose and keep out Bonds and Clemens is a business school guy, because right. Of course he is.
Right. Because of course he is, because he can figure out, you know, the odds of Rose's wagering, you know, affecting or not affecting any particular, you know, move he made, versus he wouldn't be able to understand, you know, anything about, you know, performance enhancing drugs and how they help or don't. I mean, he's just not, that's not something he'd be interested in. So,
right.
But yes, I think this is, I will say, I mean, the dispassionate nature of the article was in large measure, you know, forced by the word limit I was given. And that's a pretty interesting exercise, you know, which is basically write and then go back and, you know, take out all the words you don't need because it's too long. You know, on the internet, most of us who write on the internet, we don't often have to worry about, you know, word limits.
Yeah, I was just going to say, what are you talking about? Take words out? What's
exactly.
That?
I don't know. Exactly. And I mean, I've had that before. I've done some magazine pieces, or I've had, you know, I've had some other pieces where it needed to be, either it was part of a larger you know, anthology or something where the word count mattered. But, you know, it does force you to be a little bit more direct. And so I was frustrated by it, but in the end, I think it actually made the argument better because I took out all the effings and the, you know,
yeah, right.
The adjectives and the adverbs that,
yeah.
Well, speaking of effings and such, you grew up a Mets fan, right?
I did. I did grow up a Mets fan. I was born, and I've written about this. I wrote about this for, I think it was one of Michael Clare's like blogathons.
Yeah.
I wrote about, I was born into a family, a Dodgers loving family. The Dodgers were gone, of course, by the time I was born, but my maternal grandfather was just like the craziest Brooklyn Dodger fan. And in fact, had made my father relinquish his Yankee fandom before my grandfather would permit him to marry my mother. I mean, it was just like, I mean, very, very famous lore in my family. And, you know, very, very clear stories. You know, my mom, like almost all her friends were Brooklyn Dodger fans. She had one friend who was a New York Giants fan who, like, soon as Bobby Thompson hit the home run in 1951, like, left her, you know, walk up in Brooklyn, ran, you know, three blocks to my mother's house, ran in the house screaming, "The Giants won the pennant, the Giants won the pennant." And, you know, my mom was like, "I'm never talking to you again." I mean, eventually did speak again, but I was just like, so this is like, I mean, the way I am, it goes back many generations. Of course, now my grandfather turns in his grave because I'm not a Dodgers fan, I'm a Giants fan. But anyway, I grew up, I mean, they turned their allegiance to the Mets by the time I had come along. So,
does the family story go into any detail about this Yankee renouncement ceremony? Because I feel like that should be codified for a larger audience. Like, here's how you renounce your Yankees fandom. Do you like burn a Babe Ruth jersey or like walk counterclockwise around Yankee Stadium? Like, how does it work?
Was it more simple? Was it, "This is a picture of Joe DiMaggio. You must turn your back on it and never look at it again."
Well, I mean, it's kind of funny. My grandfather was really kind of a great storyteller when he was alive. And he basically tells the story that, you know, my parents had been dating, and he pulled my father aside one day and he said, "You know, I like you. The religion is good. You've got lefty politics. That's good, you know, but just, there's just one thing, you know, there's just this one thing that's not, it's just not going to work." So, you know, I don't know. The details of it, you know, were kept from me when I was a child. So I just assume they were sorted. And now that I'm old enough to hear like family stories, because I'm the youngest of my family. So even though I just turned 50, I've just reached the age where I'm old enough to like hear things, you know, because, you know, when I was, that's how it works. I'm still the baby in the family. So it's like, I think Wendy's old enough to know this now. I'm
You're
like,
"You're finally of age. Your grandmother used to drink." Yes. Just so you know.
So anyway, I don't know exactly what it was, but it was a story that was told over and over and over again, you know, about, "Oh, your father must have really loved your mother because he gave up the Yankees." And I'm like, and then I came to kind of think, well, I don't know. That doesn't strike me as that hard to do.
Well, I think of the Mets as the Giants' cousins, which is how I'm fine with it. I don't mind them at all because what they're basically the DNA is the, it's, you know, it's if the Dodgers and Giants, Romeo and Juliet and had a kid, it would be the Mets, right? That's essentially what they are.
Yep.
So to me, I've always been, I guess, sympathetic to the Mets. And so I guess the fact that they've, you know, fallen on their faces a lot, but they've had some really historic, fun times in their history. I've always had a soft spot for them. I guess they are kind of lovable losers in a bit of a way, in a way, more than, or at least to me they are. Anyway, I know other teams.
Yeah. What's interesting about that is, you know, I mean, they won in 69, they were in it in 73, they won in 86. So that basically covered you know, right. my childhood into my college years, and their kind of hard times came after I'd already moved out to California, and I was a dual fan, and I still really love the Mets, and I try to go to Mets games when I'm back east, and but you know, their kind of real big, you know, kind of downturn coincided with, you know, the Giants kind of really ascending, because, you know, it doesn't take that long for the three of us, I'm sure, to think back to when, you know, the Giants had, you know, never won in San Francisco and got close, you know, really, really close, and, you know, just couldn't close the deal. And, you know, they were the lovable losers, or maybe less lovable losers, but losers. So, you know, it's easy now for fans to be like, oh, you know, the Mets are so cuddly, you know, and the poor Mets and all that, you know, but it wasn't that long ago that Giants fans were kind of same spot. So.
Well, I mean, that's true. They win in 86, and then starting in 87, the Giants are pretty good. And then obviously it gets really bad when they're about to sell the team and all that stuff. But 87 and 89 are big years for the Giants, and that helped hook you there. So if you're a young Giants fan like I was, Doug, you weren't born yet, right? So
I was born in 85, actually.
So,
thank you.
I knew you were young, just not how young. But yeah, so I could see that for sure. There have been some big moments between the Giants and the Mets. I guess I'm just talking about the Mets because why not? The Mets are fun to talk about sometimes.
I agree.
I tend to think that Aubrey Huff moment is like one of the biggest moments in that. It's not even a rivalry, I don't think. But I mean, like, it's a big deal that I think about. And I go, it's so Mets that it happened to the Giants. It's just like, it was one of the most amazing moments I had ever seen on a baseball field. So.
I was actually in Philadelphia at one of my nephew's bar mitzvahs and kind of trying to watch the game on my phone. And usually I came out when Huff was moved to second base. That's
right.
Yeah, yeah. and I was, so I was, I had flo- I was, I had to be in Philadelphia for the weekend. So I flew in early to New York, and I went to the new Yankee Stadium for the first time. And then I was going to go back up to New York to go with my brother to the Mets were playing the Giants. That, you know, it was a wraparound series, right? It was supposed to be like Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. Mm-hmm. That was the Saturday game, and poured Sunday, and they got rained out, and then it ended up being a doubleheader Monday. So I was there at Citi Field. It was the first time I got to go to Citi Field to see a doubleheader on Monday. Lincecum, I think it was Lincecum and Bumgarner. Anyway, they swept the Mets, and it was just, you know, it was cold and foggy, and oh, felt like home, and everyone else was complaining. I'm like, no, this is when you play baseball, and I don't know what the problem is. So the Aubrey Huff thing stands out for me just because I was on the East Coast at the time. But I mean, Mets, Giants, you know, you got to go back to 2000, you know, the first season of the ballpark, JT Snow tying the game with the 3-1 home run in game two of the division series, and then the Giants blowing it in extras. I mean, the Mets beating the Giants, and the Giants were just, I mean, I think a superior team, but, you know, the Mets were the wild card team, and they knocked off the Giants and then played the Yankees in the World Series that year. So the last Subway Series.
I mean, the amazing thing about that Giants-Mets series was that the Giants had the best offense in the league. They had, you know, Barry Bonds as he was just becoming, as he was transitioning from Barry Bonds all-time great baseball player to Barry Bonds all-time greatest baseball player. They had, you know, Kent, and they had Ellis Burks, and in game four they got shut down by Bobby Jones, and it's just, God, really? And that's always just been the most Giants thing. Like, until they started winning, that was basically who I thought the Giants would always be, because they couldn't beat Bobby Jones with this historically great offense.
Well, a lot of chickens came home to roost in that series, too. I mean, I remember after they tied the game, I thought, why are they not putting Rob Nen in the game right now? And this was in 2002. His shoulder hadn't exploded yet. You know, sticking with Felix Rodriguez and all that going away, that was rough. So, you know, you've got Dusty managing the pitching staff. And then in that Bobby Jones game, there's a pretty famous play. It was like the Giants' only scoring chance. Rich Aurelio's at third base, and Benny Agbayani's in left field, and they're desperate to, you know, it's win or go home. And Sonny Jackson, who I'm pretty sure everyone agrees was a pretty bad third base coach, right. You know, he didn't wave him in. So a couple, and then obviously the Giants pitching not stellar for many years, right. Especially in those Bonds years, it was always pretty lean until, you know, Jason Schmidt basically was it. But yeah, you know, all those things sort of came back to get to bite them right when they didn't need it to. Sean Estes's, you know, pitching kind of meltdown. That was fun.
It was a base running meltdown, wasn't it?
Well, there was a base running meltdown, but I remember that he tried to get too cute with Timo Perez, you know, just like that kind of thing. Just
right.
the pitch sequencing and all that kind of stuff. Just those things. But yeah. But obviously another big moment, Chris Heston getting his no hitter against the Mets, also a big deal. I'm trying to think right off the top of my head. I can't even think, and I know there's one though. There's got to be like a famous Giant and Met, or Kevin Mitchell is like one. This is like the one I can think of.
Well, I mean, Willie Mays got traded to the Mets at the end of his career.
It's just Willie Mays.
Sorry, I thought Kevin Mitchell was productive when he was with the Mets. Sorry,
Eduardo Alfonso.
Do you want Eduardo Alfonso? No, that's what it was. Let us never speak of Eduardo Alfonso again. One thing I find funny about him was he's a lot of Mets fans' favorite players. Like growing up, like young Mets fans, they grew up because he was great for them. And I'm pretty sure every Giants fan loathes him.
Kevin Mitchell?
Sorry, Eduardo Alfonso.
Oh, Eduardo Alfonso.
Yeah.
He was not in the right place at the right time.
No. My only thing that I remember from him, like the play I remember distinctly, was opening day 2003. I think the Giants were in San Diego, and it was a game they won, I believe, in extra innings. Someone will fact check this, or we could, but I'm not going to. I'm going to be the old man at the bar. It was a day game that went into extra innings. But the Giants had, like, the bases loaded three or four times. They had several scoring opportunities, a chance to break the game open or break the tie. And Edgardo Alfonso, I think he left, like, five or seven or eight runners on base. He just kept, like, popping it up and making outs. So that's what I remember about Edgardo Alfonso was opening day, he's, like, hitting fifth and he goes 0 for 5. And he strands every runner. He could have won the game for them several times over. And I think that's what his whole Giants career wound up being.
Didn't they start out the season like 12-0 in 2003? I mean, they went wire to wire.
Right. That also happened. That is absolutely true. So my complaining about that in any way is ridiculous. But yes, that's absolutely what happened. I remember in like the first month or two of the season, of that season, I mean, the Giants they played great. And it was like, Jeff Kent? Who's that? Also, a lot of teams, I remember watching a lot of those games, a lot of those teams were making a lot of mistakes. They were capitalizing on basically any mistake a team made. They were all over it. And I think Kurt Ainsworth was pitching well for them in the early going
Damien Moss was pitching well that April. That's
Damien
right.
Moss was the – yeah, that's right. That's right. He was the trade in the offseason.
I would say my main gripe with Edgardo Alfonso isn't that he was bad. It's that – his being bad meant he was traded for Steve Finley, which is just an affront to everything I believe in as a Giants fan.
Yeah.
I was at that game in 2004.
Oh, stop.
I was at the game.
I don't know what you're talking about.
So that's why people wonder, like, what's wrong with Brian? Well, I was at that game.
My daughter was 9 months old, maybe 8 months old by then. And I think I was like either nursing her or, you know, trying to be playing quietly with whatever it was. And I was like, I think she's still scarred by the sound I made. I probably made some inappropriate sounds before then. I was screaming about Dustin Hermanson and.
Oh, I'm pretty sure that I left my body and ran down the steps when Cody Ransom made the error. I was on the third baseline. I was not that far from the railing. And I remember my soul leaving my body after that error happened. And Dustin Hermanson, I was actually not mad at him because he was getting squeezed. That was the thing I remember about that.
Well, he's getting squeezed. That was also his fifth consecutive day pitching. Right. Thanks, Felipe.
Yeah, right. I remember the sun, the way the sun was at Dodger Stadium, that I did not see the ball go. I didn't see, like, I saw him swing and I saw him, you know, the contact made, but I didn't see it go over the fence. I just saw all the fans. It's probably better that I didn't actually see the ball go over, but I still remember everything else. But it was very painful.
Okay, so I pulled up opening day of 2003. They did play the Padres at Qualcomm.
Okay.
Edgardo Alfonso went 0-for-4. He had a negative 0.315 WPA, win probability added, which was the lowest by a large margin for that game.
And didn't Joe Nathan get the win or the save for that game?
Felix Rodriguez got the win and Tim Worrell got the save.
But Joe Nathan pitched, I think he pitched out of a crucial jam in that game.
Joe Nathan pitched the sixth inning.
Okay, there was a big spot there. Okay.
It was Kirk Reeder. Our Kirk Reeder was opening day, followed by Joe Nathan, Scott Ayer, Felix Rodriguez, and Tim Worrell.
That is an all-time Giants pitching lineup right there.
That really
is
an all-time Giants. So let's see. Edgardo Alfonso, he didn't come to bat in the first. He reached on an error in the top of the second. What happened here? It looks like he was at bat when there was a wild pitch scoring Ray Durham, sending Jose Cruz Jr. to third and Bonds to second, but then he flew out, so he left those men on base. And then, let's see, then he grounded out with nobody on.
I remember that as being the bases loaded. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, that must be.
That was later.
No, it must have been the one where there was a wild pitch, a run scored, and, you know, then he made the third out. Yes, and then with the score tied in the eighth, there was a walk, a double, a pop fly. The bases were loaded, and he hit into a double play.
Okay.
I cannot believe you remember that. And then the Giants won the game in the top of the ninth off back-to-back home runs by, do you know?
Oh, no, I don't remember that. I think I was still fixated on Edgardo Alfonso.
So Benito Santiago and JT Snow hit back-to-back home runs. And then later in the inning, Jose Cruz Jr. singled in Marquis Grissom.
Wow. I don't remember that at all. But now I'm thinking about him, like Benito Santiago, who was juicing. But still, Qualcomm was not an easy place, that easy of a place to hit home runs, unless you're Barry Bonds. Yeah. Wow. I don't remember
there you
that. Go. Yeah.
That is, I'll never, my favorite Benito Santiago home run, like favorite, was in game 4 of the NLCS against the Cardinals in 2000.
Where he corkscrewed at home plate?
Yeah.
And I was at that game. I remember that.
I was at that game. my oldest kid, my son, was a year and a half, I guess. So he didn't need a ticket. My husband and I, you know, bought tickets off Craigslist because, you know, StubHub wasn't around in those days. We bought tickets. We sat in kind of view reserve, I don't know, 320 maybe, something like that. And it was really windy that night. It was really cold. And we kept kind of shuttling around because we had this kid and, you know, trying to keep him warm and whatever. And we were, I think we were back in the seats and, right, it was they tied it up. They were down 2-0. They tied it up, and then I don't remember who was pitching for the Cardinals, but they walked Bonds intentionally, and then Santiago hit that home run, and it seemed to hang in the air for maybe 15 minutes.
Yeah.
And I've actually gone back and listened to Kipe's call of it, you know, because we all know the cadence of his calls, right? And the timing, and, you know, like he had to stretch it out. Like it, you know, obviously the ball didn't hang in the air that much longer, but it was a foggy night. It was a windy night. And it's just like, is this ball going to get over the wall? You know, and it was just, I don't think I'll ever ever forget that.
Remember it barely clearing the wall, but I feel like on replay it cleared it. It was fine. But yeah, just, I remember it hanging up there so long.
So long.
The corkscrew was great. One thing about that game that I always tell people about is that Levon Hernandez recorded 0 swing and miss strikes in that game.
But that was still back in the time when people were talking about Levon like he was some magical postseason pitcher.
No, the Giants were the only ones talking about it back then.
Dusty was, remember?
Dusty was insistent.
Yeah.
Dusty pitched him in game 7 against the Angels. I mean, it was, you know, and didn't have Kirk Reeder warming up from the very beginning.
Kirk Reeder should have started that game.
Reeder should have started that game, but he also should have been, I mean, you know, it's game 7, hello. So I'm going to be, I don't really want to walk down like Dusty memory lane. I mostly have fond memories for Dusty, but some things really, really stick in my memory. You know, I'm not even talking about game 6, just some other, you know, screwball stuff.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. You know, I mean, stuff that you saw from the other side when they, you know, the Giants played the Reds and then ended up winning those 3 straight games in Cincinnati. And, you know, I think he'll be an improvement over Matt Williams, but I don't know. I understand why he got another shot for many, many reasons, but he's going to drive. I mean, Nats fans, I think, will be relieved that it's not Matt Williams, but Baker will drive them crazy in his own way.
Considering the Nationals have had multiple great teams that fell short in the playoffs, Baker seems like an odd choice.
Right.
That's a good point. Yeah, that's a good point. That seems to be where he's been tied to most of his career.
Yeah, for sure.
But one thing that also sticks in my mind about him, which is I think why I'm always willing to like say, he should, based on all the other flawed managers who seem like who keep getting chances, like to me, Terry Collins, I recognize that he definitely has good qualities. But to me, what happened in Anaheim was like, you know, how did he keep getting chances to opportunities to manage Bobby Valentine? There's like a lot of guys I can see why they do, but it's a bigger head scratcher. Because to me, one thing that always sticks in my mind about Dusty Baker is the players do like him a lot, and maybe he does play favorites. But he does seem to be able to bring out a certain energy in his teams that I feel like is a very positive aspect to it. So, you know, Bruce Bochy's so even keel, and he's just able to essentially manage fairly. I guess that's the book on him. But Dusty Baker seems like he can do something with these veterans, keep people positive when things get rough. And he also seems really good at taking bullets for his players, unless I'm forgetting key moments where he didn't, but he just seems like a good players manager that would reason for me why he would hang around so much. I just remember that part of him when he was with the Giants is like, oh, that's probably a very big positive, but how he deals with management and in the game tends to be a problem.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're incredibly spoiled now that we've had all these years of Bochy, because I just think there are very, very few managers kind of in any sport, frankly, who are as good as he is at both the people person stuff, you know, managing the egos, dealing with the clubhouse, shielding play. I mean, doing all that stuff that, you know, I think he does extremely well, and also being a fairly astute tactician. I mean, it's just not that easy to combine both of those things. And, he does that. I don't think there's any question that the Nationals needed someone to bring some order to the clubhouse, because it seemed like that, you know, from everything I've read and from what, you know, we could all observe, that was a huge problem. You know, there's a lot of talent on that team. And, you know, we all know, those of us who, are more stats inclined, or at least, you know, read a lot of the stats stuff. We don't really, you know, game by game, you know, the fans get kind of irritated with what a manager does, you know, oh, you should have pulled him. Oh, you should put him in. Oh, you should have, you know, double switched. But there, you know, there really isn't any way anyone's yet come up with to truly quantify, you know, how much it really affects, you know, what the wins of replacement is, or how many games are won or lost, you know, by strategy kind of thing. So, you know, and there's always stuff that fans don't know about injuries, and then there's always the issues of, well, you know, if he had pitched, you know, Jack that day, and then Jack wouldn't have been available the next day, and Jack ended up, you know, being the guy who won the game, you know. So anyway, but from a fan perspective, to have someone who, you know, has his eye on the tactics, but also is a good people person, it's great. So
it's refreshing.
It is. It is. I mean, I, you know, it is. It really, really is.
I've found a great transition from that. What isn't refreshing to me is this discussion of the designated hitter coming to the National League, which now basically the mouthpieces for the league and probably the players union are really saying, like, it's an inevitability, which is always a way, like, of the press kind of loosening, you know, or softening the ground for everyone to accept that this is coming. It's the feelers that are getting put out. And Grant's article the other day, again, folks, great content on McCoveyChronicles.com every day of the week. But saying, I believe actually this was on SB Nation, but it was essentially that, also great content, was that the DH is coming, and we're going to get used to it and be fine with it pretty quickly. I hope when I'm 80 years old, if I make it that far, that I still am as angry about it as I will be when it happens. How do the rest of you feel?
Doug, you want to go first?
Yeah, I don't like the DH at all. I think it's awful, and I hope that it gets wiped off the face of the earth in some sort of Superman flying around backwards thing.
Okay, I don't know how to follow up on that. I don't like the DH. I have, you know, spewed hell and fire about it. Maybe it's just that I'm, you know, there's so many things to get irate about. I don't know that I have it in me to continue to be irate about that. You know, I mean, I think people who kind of poo-poo, you know, the strategy, oh, you're overdoing on the strategy. I mean, it's simple as this for me. I like that there's two different games. I like that the leagues, you know, have two different things. I know it makes it very complicated when there's all year round interleague play. And that's, you know, a reason to never have all year round interleague play, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I know the cow's out of the barn on that, but, you know, I don't know, that this strikes me as not a very good reason to get rid of it. I like the strategy. I like the tradition. I, you know, agree with you guys. And it's not just about, you know, mad bum hitting, because, you know, that's really fun, but that's, you know, that's not a reason to, like, still have a rule, I don't think. You know, I just like the fact that it's a different game, and that, you know, you have to, it makes it more like, you know, the chess match that I think baseball should be. So, will I stop watching? You know, will I write 1,000-word, you know, screeds about it? Probably not anymore. Maybe I'm resigned, or maybe, you know, I don't know, bigger fish to fry. But yeah, no, it's awful, terrible, and it should never happen. But Larry Bear came out and said, after the after John Mosliak, the GM of the Cardinals, said, you know, I think there's momentum building, and that was reported. Larry Bear came out and said, I don't like it, and I don't want to see it happen. So, you know, the Giants have a fair bit of, I mean, the Cardinals are the Cardinals, but the Giants have a fair bit of sway, and, you know, we'll see. Maybe they're going to trade the DH for territorial rights. That was I know that's one of your other topics.
Was so that your way of getting into that?
Yeah, I don't. I mean, I'll talk about that if you want. But I was just thinking, how are they going to make the bear happy?
Right. It seems. I ask people whenever I get a chance who are for it. I'm like, why? Why do you need there to be uniformity across the game? And they go, exactly that, uniformity across the game. They should play balance on either side, and don't you want to watch good baseball? And I just don't get this. It's like a very childish mindset, that idea of like, I want to see every game be 8-6. and I, not that it would with the DH necessarily, but I just don't buy into the argument like, oh, you'll get more offense and that's a better game to watch, when, because it's just that it's more dramatic. It is actually more dramatic to go, the pitcher's up in two batters. What's going to happen to the eighth place hitter? You know, what's going to happen here? Like, are they going to pitch to him, or the bases are loaded? Is the pitcher going to do something here? You know, are they going to have to pinch hit and pull a guy? He's got a no hitter going, you know? So all those things to me are dramatic and great and entertaining, and focusing on one aspect of baseball. This is the part. We are intelligent enough beings to focus on multiple things at any given time. And if you're really that bent out of shape about 2-1 games, then go watch an American League game. That's a option available to you. But it's not like you're going to get measurably better baseball. There's a lot of bad baseball in the American League too, and they have the DH. So it doesn't really, that argument doesn't mesh with me. And then I think this, with the idea that the players are going to suddenly have more job opportunities, I think it's kind of like the fans, where we want something so badly and it's good on its face. Or I guess you shouldn't say that, but like consumers, we think it's great if we have a la carte cable programming. Well, now we're going to be paying the same for fewer channels, because now everything, you know, we're going to have to pay $7 a month for every station we want. But, you know, the players wanted, if the players want more job opportunities, it's going to backfire in some ridiculous way. I mean, to me, it makes the most sense that they should, that the players should have more free agents who can, the draft should be a little easier. There should be more players coming into the game, but a lot of these decisions are being made of the older guys. How do we keep them getting work and being well paid? And I understand that, but it also has a short-sightedness to it. And you're only adding, at best, you know, half the league, 15 other teams, and how many of them are going to actually use that slot to buy a new player? They're probably going to do what most teams do and rotate guys in and out of the DH spot. So I don't think it answers that question, and so it seems like a very, again, short-sighted way of doing it, all in the, it doesn't make the game prettier.
I agree with all those things, and I'd also say, unless rosters also expand, it's just trading one kind of player for another kind of player. I mean,
if rosters expand, they're just going to add more pitchers. We already know it's going
to
happen.
Well, but I mean, if they add the DH to the National League and don't expand rosters, then you're just trading a, you know, potentially successful, you know, bat guy off the bench for a relief pitcher, most likely. Or so, yeah. You know, it's not, I mean, yes, it could extend, you know, it could extend the life of some aging hitters, you know, at least as the DH is now kind of formulated, the way we think about it. But if we had the DH in both leagues, you know, I mean, the idea of it, you know, it might change over time how that position is used. At the same time, you know, teams are getting smarter about the whole kind of third time through the order curse or whatever, you know. And, you know, like the Rays last year moved to really kind of shorten, you know, starts for their pitchers and use relievers, you know, much more. So, you know, maybe you don't mean, I haven't gone back to look at their roster, but, you know, maybe the Rays, you just carry one less utility infielder, you know, if you have the DH or you have a DH who's not really a DH because you want to keep as many relievers, you know, as you want. So, you know, it's, unless the rosters go to 26, it's a zero sum game. The question is kind of which specialty, you know, gets favored status, right?
And it'll be pitching. We already know the answer. It'll be pitching.
Well, but that's what I'm saying. If you get right, well, if you get a DH in the National League, you don't know whether, I mean, you know, do teams carry one fewer reliever, you know, that kind of thing. So
Bruce Bochy will have 15 pitchers to available. He'll love it. So there have been times where I'm like, how many pitchers do you want to carry, Giants?
And the Giants are like, have you seen that our starting staff is going three innings a game? We want all of them.
Wendy, what have you thought about the offseason this year? We asked Grant this question. How does it feel to be front runners, or do you not agree?
I really hate it, and I want people to stop saying good things about the Giants. Like, just stop. Yeah. I was very disappointed the Giants didn't get Greinke for a variety of reasons. Number one, he's Greinke and he's cool and he's smart. And oh my God, that would have been great. I'm sure the Dodgers aren't happy that he's pitching for the Diamondbacks, but getting Greinke it probably would have just made my entire year, regardless of, you know, what happened after that. And I'm cautiously optimistic because Dave Rigetti, you know, is a warlock, that, you know, Cueto and Samardzija will be good to very good on a consistent basis. And I think, you know, looking at kind of, you know, once Price signed, once Greinke signed, I like that the Giants were, I like that they gamed it out. I like that they had a plan. You know, I like that they knew what they wanted to do kind of as soon as, you know, one piece fell into place, they moved on, you know, another piece fell into place, they went to plan C or D, whatever it was. You know, a lot of things have to go right, but that's always true, right? I mean, it's always true. The Giants, in the years that they won the World Series, they, you know, had, for the most part, you know, really, they had good health. You know, in 2014, they lost Pagan, you know, they had situations where they lost people, but, you know, you can't have a situation like where you lose a Posey and then, you know, everything kind of just works fine. So of course everything has to go right. But that's kind of true every season, right? I mean, oh, the Warriors only won the championship last year because they were the last team standing. I mean, that's not true, but it is also true. They were very lucky and they had a lot of good health. So I like the Denard Span signing. You know, I'm going to be very interested to see how, you know, what happens in left field. I tweeted about this the other day after the Span signing. Kruko was on the radio talking about, we all know Pagan's a diva, but, you know, he'll do whatever Bochy asks. And I'm like, yeah, that's the very definition of someone who's not a diva.
Right.
So I don't know exactly what you're saying. You know, we'll see. I mean, I think it's we'll see what happens, whether Pagan ends up platooning with Blanco or they just kind of rotate around and, you know, we'll have to see what Span's health is. I wouldn't have minded a bigger signing, but, you know, they did commit a lot of, once they made those commitments to Samardzija and Cueto, it was pretty clear they weren't going to go, you know, get even an Alex Gordon. And I'm fine with that. So, you know, the biggest, I think one of the biggest uncertainties and one that could really affect the team's fortunes is Matt Cain. You know, it's amazing that, you know, how, we're not that, you know, we're, what is it, four seasons, I guess, since the, you know, 2012 when, you know, Lincecum came out of the bullpen in the postseason and Cain, you know, pitched well in the postseason, had the perfect game, and Lincecum's gone without any fanfare at all. And Cain is like, oh, hi, I still have $80 million on my contract. And he's the fifth starter. So I'm really, you know, just on a personal level, pulling for him, you know, to have a positive season. But I also think it's going to be really important for him to have a good season. So I'm cautiously optimistic, which is probably a bad sign.
Yeah, I'm not someone who wants to really pull down hard on the whole even year magic idea.
I hate it.
I think it's a bad look for Giants fans, because not that we need to be miserable or miserly or just, you know, really angry about it or look at spit in the face of the good fortune that has befallen us over the past 6 years. But at the same time, it's like, remember where you came from and realize that this can all go away like that. And I just feel like, you know, front runners or that kind of attitude, it's just weird. It's like tempting. It's asking the baseball gods to do it, to do something. It's as, you know, it's they, and they'll do it. They'll laugh in the face of it right away. And yes, I firmly believe in the baseball gods. They exist. We see them all the time.
Yeah, I also, what I don't like about it, and this is just like my nerd hat on with neon nerd lights flashing, is that, you know, it's like I'm over here screaming, correlation is not causation. Correlation is not, I mean, like, I don't know. It's just, yes, they won every other year, but you understand those are independent things.
Right.
And hello, and, you know, now the Giants are getting into it. And, you know, I get it from a marketing standpoint, why they play it up. You know, and Denard Span talked about that. Oh, I hear that, you know, they win every other year. But it really bugs me. Because some people, you know, for example, my 15-year-old son is just like, you know, when things like, you know, when they weren't doing well last year, well, of course not. You know, like of course, because this isn't how it works. It's like, oh my God, like, stop saying that.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it feels like 2011 was the way that it was, you know, it was clearly the Giants' best chance of going back to back, which is very difficult, but the Royals made it look extraordinarily easy to be just as, or better, just as competitive or more competitive the following year after the World Series. And the Yankees used to do it pretty consistently as well. So,
well, the Giants, I mean,
the Giants relied on two collapses in their three World Championships, the Padres and the Brewers, essentially, to get into the playoffs.
Right. The Giants pitching in 2011 on almost every statistical level was far, the regular season pitching was far superior to 2010, 2012, 2014. The offense was just historically, you know, I mean, Posey was a huge part of it. You know, Aubrey Huff, you know, fell off, Cody Ross, you know, I mean, you know, and it was one of the reasons why I was then and still stand by being in favor of the Carlos Beltran trade. I thought that was actually, that's what they should have done. And it didn't work out, even though he actually hit very well, you know, he was hurt and blah, blah, blah. They didn't end up missing, you know, by that much. And the thing that bothered me so much about 2011 was that I felt like Bochy gave up too early. Like there were, especially vis-a-vis the wild card, even though that was the year, you know, it was like the Giants were going to have to jump over like three or four teams, but that's exactly what happened. I mean, that was the year everything kind of went crazy on the last day of the season. So I felt like they kind of threw in the towel too early, but yeah, I mean, without Posey's injury, you know, you never know, but the pitching was magnificent in 2011. Absolutely like off the charts, magnificent. And they could have, you know, they easily could have with a few other tweaks here and there, you know.
That was kind of the case with 2009 as well, just in terms of how great the pitching was and how abysmal the offense was. One of the national guys, Casey Stern, who he mentioned the other day, he said, I mean, obviously a lot of these guys, national guys, they really don't pay attention. They don't pay attention seemingly to the National League teams very much. And certainly the Giants, not that much considering that they have won three World Series recently. But so I take it with a bit of a grain of salt, but now we're talking about 2011 and even 2009. This is reminding me of, that's reminding me of his comment, which is that he was concerned about the Giants this year in the sense that, like you said, if things don't go the Giants' way, here's how it can look bad. And one of those things he said was he felt like the Giants' offense had the potential to be like the Angels' lineup last year, which is that they've got a couple of big guys, but then everything else could potentially go and be really bad for them. And I was trying to, and then he went and explained it. And he's like, what are you going to get out of Posey and Pence? Are they going to be able to carry everything if Belt's hurt or streaky or Panic doesn't come back or Duffy isn't exactly what he was last year and Brandon Crawford isn't quite the guy he was last year offensively? Pagan gets hurt, Span gets hurt. You know, those are all things that are pretty likely too. And I was just thinking about it going, well, I mean, the Giants have tried very hard to build up their depth so that they can plug in holes. Remember, it was Zach Wheeler or Gary Brown that was the rumor for that trade for Beltran, and that look what happened. They know they needed offensive depth, and it still didn't work out. They've been trying for years to build from within to get that offensive help as best they can. But yeah, ultimately, things are going to go, you know, they're going to break. We can't really predict. They do the best they can, but I feel like the Giants, I've said this, Doug's heard it a million times. The Giants did everything that they were supposed to do, thought they had to do, and any reasonable person from the outside looking in should see that, you know, they could have done. I feel like they did everything they could and let the chips fall where they may this year.
Right. I mean, also a lot of it has to do with, you know, what happens in Arizona, what happens with the Dodgers. I mean, right. So,
well, the Dodgers are the best team in baseball. They are every year. They have the most money.
Yeah,
they're like the Transformers movies. They made a lot of money, therefore they're good. I mean, that's how it works. So,
or Minions,
or Minions, right? These are the pinnacle of modern cinema, and Dodgers are the pinnacle of baseball. So,
don't get me started on Minions. Like, I remember once, that's Despicable Me, right?
Right. And then they spun off into their own series.
So since I, at the time, had kids who, I mean, now my kids are older and probably wouldn't, thankfully, go see movies like that. I remember taking my daughter to see Despicable Me or Despicable Me 2 or both. I'm sure I had to go to both. And then tweeting like something like, you know, there were actual adults in the theater without children. And I'm very concerned for the future of our country. And all these people responded like, the minions are so great. I don't know how you don't think they're just the funniest thing. And I was just like, oh my God. And like smart people, like baseball writers, other people, oh, the minions are just hysterical. And now we have Donald Trump. So I, you know.
No, you drew a line. Oh my goodness.
I just
you connected that red yarn. I was not expecting you to go Trump there.
Yeah. It's just.
Wendy,
it's
so, I was not expecting you to have the hottest take in podcast history.
It's so easy to do the Donald Trump thing now. I know that was a complete cop out. I'm sorry. I just went for the brass ring there. No, I'm sorry. Yeah, Minions, I just don't get it. And if I really thought about it, I probably could write a pretty good hot take think piece about, you know, the success of things like the Minions and just all that stuff and the rise of people like Donald Trump. Every time I see
something, you're still drawing the line. You're doubling down.
Every time. I actually have a long running list of things. I keep a little – every time like there's something that I just think, oh my God, I'm going to bang my head against the wall about this, I have a little sheet I write down and say, you know, this is – I keep a little like a list of things that I think, you know, that are reflective of what's going on in American culture. You know, you can't draw a direct line to Donald Trump, but I think kind of contribute to a culture and an atmosphere that allows something like that kind of nonsense to flourish.
I'm dealing with people my age making, liking, embracing Mighty Morphin Power Rangers fan films and dark takes on the Power Rangers and like gritty reboots of that. So there, I'm with you on some degree of there's like an embedded infantilism in the cultural psyche, and it's. And also, it's either people don't want to grow up or something about the nostalgia, the toxicity of nostalgia that we have going on. I feel like that's just as bad, too. And what is Trump but like an 80s nostalgia? And the personification of that gross time that somehow people are still fond of, because for some reason we're always looking back going, those were the good old days. Yeah, things were the good old days when you're young, so you don't have responsibilities, but maybe the line to me is, maybe the line you draw is Minions to Trump, but maybe it goes Reagan, Minions, Trump.
So. I'm saying Reagan to Hook, because Hook was all about how you should never grow up, which is a stupid message. And that's a really popular movie that every child watched in school 20 times somehow.
Rufio was a minor celebrity in the Bay Area, obviously. It was cool if you knew him or knew someone who knew him. I remember that.
Yeah.
Because he went to Pittsburgh High or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just Hook. I mean, there's been a Peter Pan kind of revival, right? There was the NBC live broadcast. My daughter has either been in or seen, I don't, you know, five local productions of Peter Pan over the last several years. That's probably true all the time, but yeah, I just.
Well then, so Hook was Steven Spielberg. Steven Spielberg, a big guy in the 80s and 90s. Maybe this nostalgia problem in Trump is the result of, we'll go Reagan, Spielberg, Minions, Trump. Maybe it's Hollywood's fault that we are this way then. Maybe people have been right all along. Hollywood is going to ruin this country.
There's no question in my mind that, you know, fame as a thing to reach for, you know, fame qua fame, like it's good to be famous for the purpose of being famous, which is something that has fed, you know, Trump's, you know, it's one thing to be a successful businessman. It's another thing to be, you know, The Apprentice and all over. We do create and idolize celebrity for the purpose of celebrity just way, way too much in this country. And now, you know, there were a lot of seeds that were sown purposefully and otherwise that, you know, have kind of given rise to people like Donald Trump, and he's not the only one. So anyway, let's go back to baseball, because 99% of the people who were listening to this podcast now turned it off. So,
oh, that was a long, we'll see. I'm not sure. Can bring questions. Let's go to our Twitter questions and see if we can get back on baseball topic. Doug, do you have them? I can find some.
I have here. Why don't I find the ones that were tweeted at Wendy directly? Because those were all good. For some reason,
I have some of those.
Okay.
So one of them was from Sully Baseball at Sully Baseball, who actually had three questions, like a jerk.
Right.
But we're gonna go with the first two. So the first one is, where will the A's be playing in 5 years? And the second is, where will Lincecum end up? Which is a pretty easy one for Brian at least to answer, because we know what he thinks.
Oh, oblivion. Sorry.
The A's will be playing in oblivion and Lincecum will be pitching for them there? Is that your answer?
Yes, that's my answer. I feel like that's a strong answer.
I think the A's will be in Oakland in 5 years. They'll still be at the Coliseum, but there will be, in 5 years, there will be either a new ballpark under construction or soon to be under construction, also in the East Bay for the A's. That's my prediction. Lincecum, good question. I mean, I think he'll get a minor league deal, and I predict he will be on a major league roster come opening day. I don't really have a sense yet where that will be. Doug, what do you think?
I think the A's are going to stick around in Oakland. It seems like they have to. And also, it would be stupid to leave Oakland when all the money has started to pour into Oakland, because people literally can't put it into San Francisco anymore.
Right.
It's the smartest place for them to stay. Lincecum, it's tough. I mean, maybe a minor league deal with Seattle. That's been the default answer on him for years, because he's from Seattle. And it's kind of a stupid answer, because that's never, like, maybe twice in the history of baseball has that been the reason that a player went somewhere. But
Yeah, it's tough to see, just because it's really more about the availability of a possible starting spot down the line for him than anything, because I think he still wants to be a starter. I guess I just have to say Seattle and kind of punt.
Yeah.
I'm sticking with Oblivion. But actually, with the Oakland answer, I mean, that's where the money is. And I mean, the A's, to me, they have to stay in Oakland. Although it's funny because they're one of the franchises that have moved the most in their history. So it wouldn't be so ridiculous. But Oakland is, for me, at least in my life growing up, they've always been a great baseball town. And I think they should be there. And they should always be trying to keep the Giants honest and getting up in the Giants business as often as possible.
Oh, I mean, totally agree with
that. The Giants were the laughing stock, really, especially through the 80s. And the A's were sort of the class of the area, and they knew how to do things. And the Giants always seemed like they were trying to figure it out. And now they have it figured out. And I don't think the A's are quite a laughing stock by all their decision making. I don't feel like they're hapless or anything like that. But it just seems like they're so focused on getting the rich man's credit card or like having a blank check from a city that's all their focus has been on, that they've probably missed out on at least a couple of other potential opportunities, that if they had explored more than one route 10 years ago, they'd probably be in a different situation today. Like we could all say about our own lives, don't you think?
Exactly. I'm really rooting for the A's to stay in Oakland. And, you know, from the perspective of someone who, I don't think cities should throw public money at owners and all that stuff. I think that Libby Schaff, who's the mayor of Oakland, has actually handled all the A's and Raiders stuff incredibly well. And it's such a nice change of pace, not just from politicians in general, but also from her predecessor, who was just terrible. I mean, she wasn't smart. She said things she shouldn't have said. She promised things she shouldn't have promised. She didn't know what she was doing. I was hoping that the NFL would just resolve it in a way that made the Raiders go away, because I don't like football at all and I don't really care. And that would open the door for the A's to get their ballpark sooner rather than later. And maybe that will happen sooner rather than later, and it won't take another 5 years, but it makes so much sense for the A's to stay in the East Bay for all the reasons that you mentioned. I think something will happen relatively soon. Now that the Tampa Bay Rays have been given permission to go look at other sites, you know, I will say I don't love everything about what Rob Manfred is doing, but he's Bud Selig liked to create commissions and let things just kind of play out. And I think Rob Manfred is smart enough to understand that, like, the world is, you know, keep going. You want to keep up, you got to be an action person. So I think something will come together soon for the A's. That also could be completely optimistic, right? My thinking.
Tim Lincecum could buy the A's. It could just be, who knows?
Tim Lincecum and Barry Zito could buy the A's.
That's right. With the Giants' money. How about that? What's the next question?
Okay, so Oakland Raiders at Raider Sparky asked, why don't more hitters bunt down the third base line against this shift for lefties? And then sent a picture of the shift, because that's very helpful on a podcast. Mm-hmm. Just kidding, Raider Sparky. But it was the one where, you know, the third base is even closer to second base than the shortstop. Usually, the third baseman is closer to second base than the shortstop usually is. So there's just like a massive, massive hole on the left side.
The shortstop is on the first base side of second base. Second baseman's in right, shallow right field. First baseman's way back at first base. Yeah,
the Barry Bonds shift, the wishbone defense, Ted Robinson used to call it when he was calling for the game for the Giants. So why don't more hitters bunt down the third base line? Wendy?
I have no idea, because it's so obviously the thing that should happen. I mean, I have no idea. I mean, it you know, I've had this conversation with so many people. I take the, they should bunt or they should take advantage of it. They should learn to hit the other way. And people say, oh, you know, you just, you don't need to put that pressure on Major League Baseball players. Another thing they have to work on. I mean, I'm sorry, you're a Major League Baseball player. You've been bunting since you've been in Little League and you have to learn how to, right? I mean, Brandon Crawford laid down that beautiful bunt in the playoffs. Brandon Belt laid down that beautiful bunt in the postseason when they never done it. I mean, just learn how to do it. It's the pitchers to do it. Just do it. And first of all, it makes so much sense. You're not just helping your team. You're also, you do things enough to kind of screw around with, you know, the prediction models, then the defense will start to open up for you. I mean, it makes so much sense. So I agree with Rocky Raider or whoever that was. Sorry, I don't remember their handle.
For me, I mean, the answer must just be it's really hard. Like, I'm not a baseball player. I don't know, but that has to be it. But the thing I always go back to is that Barry Bonds did try to bunt. I remember at least once. It was in a game against the Rockies in 2001. He'd homered in, I think, the fourth inning, and he kind of tweaked his back a little bit. And so he would have come out of the game. But he was like, well, you know, the Giants had almost batted around. He knew he'd get another plate appearance in the fifth. So he stayed in like an extra inning. He comes up. It's hard for him to swing. So he tries to bunt down the third base line. He doesn't do it. It doesn't work. It goes foul. So on the next pitch, he swings and hits an opposite field homer.
Of course he does.
That doesn't have a lot to do with the question, but I wanted to tell that story because Barry Bonds is amazing.
I think it's pride. I feel like that's, to me, is a more obvious answer. I think it offends them and they want to beat it. And I think that bunts, for those players, bunting is not a part of their game. And I think that there's an ego thing about, I'm not going to change my game. I'm going to beat you with my best. They feel like it's not their best. To me, that seems even simpler. But I tend to think that the younger guys coming up, that might be less of an issue. Because the shifts to me, like, I don't see Ryan Howard doing that. You know what I mean? He's 70 years old, so he's not going to change his ways. He's 70 years old. He's still signed for 10 more years. I think that's how that contract goes. But he, you know, he's never going to bunt against that shift and watch someone's going to at me with video of him bunting against it. But I just don't see – I see guys come – I see Bryce Harper is probably going to be more likely to do that. But how often do they put that same shift on for him? I know they've done it. I think I've seen it. I'm pretty sure I've seen it. But, you know, he seems like a guy who would be – he's also 15 years old. I see him being totally flexible with changing it. But it's recent enough I just don't see – most of baseball adapting to wanting to adapt to it. I think they're more offended by it.
Yeah.
Which is just, you know, is just ego and nonsense.
Right. But that's all ego is nonsense. And it's pervasive.
No, I agree with that. But I mean, which are the pitchers that succeed more and have longer careers? The ones who learn, you know, a third pitch, a fourth pitch, you know, are willing. I mean, it just, the notion, I agree. It's just, it's very, very frustrating from a fan perspective or from just a human perspective to watch someone who's really, really good at something not be willing to adjust, right? And baseball is all about adjusting to what the other side is doing. So I think it's very, very frustrating to hear people just say, you know, I'm not going to do that. It's not my game. Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, they're not going – they'll adjust, but it's always like a conditional adjustment. I'm not going to change my game. I'm going to adjust to the fact that I'm expecting fastball and they're not throwing me fastballs. That's about the extent of the adjustment. But, you know, no one's – it's hard to change these guys' ways. It's how they got to where they are. You know what I mean? So then – you definitely know what I mean. I'm just – there. That's the block. And, yeah, it's silly, but – how much of baseball isn't silly? Like 5%?
Yeah.
Like the least silly part of baseball is probably when the little kids get the balls at the beginning of games and they run out with the players. That's probably the least silly part of baseball. That's cute. So, what next question?
All right, this is kind of an easy one, but let's do it anyway. Kizar Soze asked, what's the best stadium to be a visiting Giants fan? I mean, Petco, right?
Right.
Are we not counting Petco? Because those are basically home games.
I've never been to a Giants game at Petco, so I can't speak to that. I think it is a good question, though.
It's pretty great to go to Petco, to be honest. I would say that's if you take that out of the equation, I don't know. I can't really say. I've been to Oakland, L.A. I'm trying to think as a Giants fan. Oakland and L.A. That's really the only other. And Anaheim. Those are the only. And Anaheim was fine. And L.A. is rough. And Oakland is rough but fine.
Oakland is rough in a good way. I have been to Giants games at Citi Field, and there's, oh, you know, just because affinities, there's always a huge contingent of Giants fans. It's pretty fun to go to a Giants game at Citi Field. I will say that.
People who have been to Giants games at Safeco in Seattle, they say it's pretty good there too.
I believe but I that. Haven't.
So.
I went to a Braves game. Atlanta too. Turner Field, and that was fine, but that was kind of like Anaheim. No one really cared. So, yeah.
Okay. So last question we'll say, right?
Yep. Sure. Sure.
This is from, I'm picking. This is from Michael G at Cyclic Amp 24.
Of course it is.
He said, two-part question. Do the Giants offer Belton extension this year, and do they restructure Bumgarner's deal?
I say no and no. First of all, they're not going to restructure Bumgarner's deal.
Right.
They'll probably, I forget how many years has left. When they get close to the opt-out, the option years, which the Giants, of course, unless something happens, will exercise their option. But when they get close to that, I think they'll sign him to a further extension, but they're not going to redo the deal. It's all this talk. The Royals have so much pressure on them. They need to redo Salvi Perez's deal. You know, it's so team friendly. It's like, actually, there's no pressure on them at all. I mean, do you understand how economics works? There's no, none, zero pressure on them. They have him locked up, and whether you think that's a good deal or not, I mean, I guess there's the issue of good faith and, you know, will he want to sign an extension, you know, if they don't make do, but I don't see that being an issue with Bumgarner. So they'll extend him further when they get close to the option years, but they're not going to restructure the deal. And on Belt, you know, there's been a lot of talk about it. And then there's been a lot of like, well, they've already done all these big contracts, but I also think the Giants want to move Posey to first base.
No.
They do.
Ryan.
Posey doesn't want to. The Giants will let him catch kind of as long as they feel like it, you know, he wants to, all things being equal. But the Giants do want to move Posey to first, in my humble opinion. And so I'm kind of not convinced that they're even really that serious about a long-term deal for Bell.
Well, since from the very beginning, I've said that we're probably 2 years away from Posey moving over to first base full time. Because yeah, that's what it seems like where it's trending, especially just the amount of time Bruce Bochy is openly saying he wants to give Posey so much time off, and he's being very open about it. It's not tipping the hand, but it's like definitely there's smoke there. It's definitely going to happen. I could see them extending Belt through, like signing a 2-year deal through some arbitration years.
Maybe this year
and next, just to get some of that cost certainty built in. And then I think that might be something that's good for both parties, because if they lock in that number, you know, then he knows what he's. You know, his performance could exceed that or stay equal to that in that third year. And who knows, he might be traded by then. So I don't know. I could see that happening, though.
I think my buyout is last 2 years, but I just don't see them doing a long-term, you know, a 3 to 4 to 5 year deal with Bell. I just don't see that happening.
I can see them trying to get 1 or 2 free agent years if, you know, if he's open to it, which he probably wouldn't be because this is, you know, it's going to be his best chance to get a big contract. I'd say they're definitely not going to try to change anything about Bumgarner's deal. John Shea just wrote an article about it, and it was weird because it's like, John, they have like 4 years. This is the reason you sign guys as early as they sign Bumgarner, because they signed Bumgarner to an extension after like his first year or second year in the league.
It was going into the 2012 season, I think.
Yeah, and that's really early, and that's a lot of risk for the team to take. And so the payoff for that is that if it pays off like it is now, they get some cost savings. So I think it's a little silly to expect that. It would be in those option years, like you said. If I think it's possible they offer something to Belt, I don't know that it's going to be something that he wants to do. So that's kind of my take on it.
And about Bumgarner, I could see them offering, yeah, same thing. It'll happen in the option years if they do it. And I could see the Giants restructuring one or maybe even two of those option years and turning, you know, making them like the first 2 years of a 5 year, you know, of a 7 year extension if they got really crazy, which that's a lot of risk for a pitcher. But, you know, adding 5 more years onto the deal would be essentially what it would be. I could see something like that happening. But, yeah there's absolutely no reason for the Giants to do that. And it's just kind of, it's one of those things. That's the risk both sides take. And, you know, the Giants have handed out an opt-out this season. They've taken on risk themselves. You know, signing Matt Cain to that deal, that was a risk. And that's not, you know, that's kind of blown up in their faces. The Lincecum extension, the Pence one, that was not exactly risky. That was an interesting deal because they were signing him for market rate, and now he is being paid basically commensurate with what he would be reasonably worth on the open market. And so the Giants, are, you know, they gamble, they take bets, and some pay off and some don't, which is all gambling. So I think they're set. I agree with the consensus here. All right. So those are our Twitter questions. You can ask us about anything, really, but baseball questions, I guess, are pretty cool.
So while we were talking, David Lennon of New York Newsday tweeted that Manfred is saying he thinks there is kind of inexorable march toward the DH in both leagues, and it's something that will be negotiated during the next round of collective bargaining agreement, which is basically going to happen this season with the new agreement to start in effect for 2017. So I don't know. I mean, if Trump getting elected makes me move to Canada, I don't know what like a Trump DH 2017.
Well, there's nothing but the DH in Canada. You won't be able to escape it.
I know. What about Australia? Does Australia have the DH only?
Australia doesn't have really any offense, so I mean, it doesn't.
Oh my god!
I've tried to watch those Australian baseball games, and they're rough.
And I think Japan uses the DH, right?
There's nowhere left to go. Actually. Yeah, there's no. We can't escape it. And it's funny because the most popular sport on the planet has nil-nil games. So it's funny the idea that someone would bring up offense as a reason to make a game entertaining. So. Okay, so we're going to play a game. First, a quick update on a long-standing game. A long time ago, Doug and I played a game called AAV, where we tried to guess the average annual value of free agent contracts, and we picked 5, and whoever got closest, best out of 5, won the contest. The winner would be able to write a burn piece on the other writer about their worst takes on the Cubby Chronicles, which for me was going to be tough because Doug doesn't have any, and it's going to be really easy for Doug because I have nothing but bad takes. And we have the results of the game. And I won. So I get to spend weeks and weeks figuring out how to burn Doug. And I don't know, but we'll figure it out. I won because Justin Upton's AAV is 23.125 or 22.125 million. And I think I said 26 and you said 27 million.
Yeah, I said 27 and a half. Okay, but 27. Close enough.
Well, he's worth 27 and a half million AAV, I feel.
I think so.
Yeah. So that's the update there. Riveting, I know. So expect that, I don't know, in the next couple of weeks, the slam piece of Doug Brazzoni's worst takes. And this week we're going to play State of the Union. So last week was the president's final State of the Union. And I thought maybe going into this season, we could take some Giants players and get in a character and figure out what their State of the Union address would be. Maybe they'll say this at like those season ticket gatherings that they record that are a lot of fun. So they have to like give a speech and talk about the year that was and their hopes for the year ahead. So someone's going to throw out a player and the other two are going to do a bit essentially and try to give a very quick State of the Union speech. Doesn't have to be elaborate. So Wendy, you can throw out a player first and Doug and I will struggle to be funny with it.
My player is Johnny Cueto.
Johnny Cueto. All right, I'll go first.
Okay.
I feel like the state of my union is like my slider. It's strong. It's working. It's doing everything I want it to do. I feel like the state of my union is great because my union is usually atop a horse, and and I feel like that gives me a lot of extra strength. I won a World Series, so the state of my union is really strong because I won a World Series, and now I signed this really, really nice contract when a lot of people said I probably shouldn't because I have some arm issues, which are kind of red flags. But the state of my union, like my arm, is strong. It's not going to do anything I don't want it to do, which I really just want it to get through these next 2 years so I can opt out and make a lot more money with another big deal. Thank you. God bless. And God bless me, Johnny Cueto.
Okay. I believe the state of the Cueto is strong, very strong, and growing stronger by the day. Everyone knows that social media is the way to go now. It's what really gets you the money. It's what gets you followers. It's what gets you acclaim. And my social media presence is unbeatable. No one has more pictures on Instagram of themselves with horses than me, Johnny Cueto. Thank you. God bless me.
That was a good one. All right, Wendy, so you got it?
I think so. Oh, I think the Nationals just signed Cespedes too.
They're making a push, it looks like.
Oh, they're making a push.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Okay.
All right.
I can come up with someone, but I'm blanking on this name right now. Shoot. Oh. Okay. All right. Ere Adrianza.
Oh.
That's cruel.
Okay.
You going first, Doug?
Sure. Hi. The state of the Adrianza is good. I'm definitely a major league player. I'm going to work on being better at hitting. Thank you. I think that's it. He's not chatty.
The state of Ere Adrianza is not as strong as it used to be when I was, for no apparent reason, on the Giants 40-man roster when I clearly shouldn't have been. So now that I'm not on the Giants 40-man roster, the state of Ere Adrianza is very sad.
No, he's still on the roster, isn't he?
No, he's not on the roster, is he?
Yeah.
Hold on, here we go. I just like the state of – it's sad. I like the – that would be the worst set of state to
He's still on the 40-man roster? Oh my goodness, the state of our geriatrics is so happy. Wait, wasn't he cut at the end of last year?
No, he's one of their six infielders.
Yeah. They don't have another backup shortstop.
Who am I thinking of?
Oh, Juan Perez?
Huh?
Juan Perez? Yeah.
Oh, somebody else. Okay. I blew that one.
No, it's totally fun. That's what Adrianza would do. Yeah.
he didn't even know he was on the roster. He was surprised. He's like, really? Still?
Wait, but who?
Thanks.
Who was the infielder that wasn't it Adrianza though that we used to all just complain incessantly? Was
Arias?
Oh, Arias was cut. Yeah. Arias is gone, but Arias isn't the one. It was Adrianza though, right? Well, for a long time it was. Oh God, who was that pitcher that they kept protecting on the 40-man roster?
Oh, Hinshaw.
Yes. Oh my God. Like, oh, we can't make that trade because then we'd have to cut Alex Hinshaw. It's like, come up with a better answer, please.
Just cut Alex Hinshaw.
But then that was Adrianza for a long time. Then he came up. Yeah, you're right. I don't think he'll be long for this world. But we'll see.
That, you heard it here first, folks. Wendy Thurm predicting the death of Ari Adrianza.
No. No, that is not, in fact, the case. But, you all know, right. See how it plays out.
All right, Doug, last one.
Last one, and I'm just giving this to you as more of a fun character to play.
Okay.
The state of Hunter Pence.
I knew you were going to say Hunter Pence.
Wendy, would you like to go first?
I would like to do. I'm thinking about that kind of blooper thing at the end of the 2012 World Series movie where all the players kind of make fun of Pence's inspirational speeches from that postseason run. And so I just want everyone to imagine right now I'm doing like the eyes, the way Jeremy Affeldt did them, like holding my eyes like wide open, you know?
Okay.
I love you guys. I love you guys. The State of the Union is like, just, I love you guys. We all need to see what Ryan Terrio is going to wear to the ballpark tomorrow. I love you guys. The State of the Union is I'm engaged. I got engaged at Disneyland, which is just like the coolest thing ever. And now I have a scooter and I have like hoverboards and, you know, I just can't wait to like jump up in the outfield and high five Denard Span. And it's just like, I love you guys. I love you guys.
That's standing ovation in the gallery.
Thank you.
I don't know how I'm going to be able to follow that. Here we go. Oh yeah. The state of the Pence is great. You know, it's just, I got my video games. I've got my fiance. It was a rough hibernation cycle last year. But you know, I persevered. A lot of injuries. But I got really in touch. I got really in touch with my subspace domain, my spiritual healer. You know, and I'm gonna come back stronger than ever. I've spliced my DNA with the Gorgon. I'm gonna come back stronger than ever. And you're not gonna know what's gonna happen. And oh, sorry. I expelled some fluids over there, but that's okay. I'm just trying to reproduce. We're gonna have a great year. And going forward, I'm gonna hit a home run. And I'm gonna catch the ball. And I gotta go. Okay, bye. And then he dematerializes and beams up. That's it.
That's a good one.
I think Wendy won. Wendy won. That was well done.
Do I get garlic fries for that or what?
Sure. Next time I see you in 3 years. All right. So that's how we do it. Wendy, is there anything you want to plug? Is there anything you want to get out there to the people who might have missed it if they're not following you on Twitter, which they should? Give them your Twitter handle.
Hanging Sliders, which is still a pretty good Twitter handle, I will say. I've debated back and forth whether to just switch it to my name because I'm writing kind of lots of non-sports stuff now too, but I'm going to pat myself on the back and say it's such a good Twitter handle. I'm not going to change it.
Yeah, you should stick with it.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, my baseball writing, certainly heading into this coming season, is a little bit up in the air. But I do have a story coming out tomorrow that has nothing to do with baseball. But I reported the story for a long time, and it's a really fun story. It has to do with kind of a non-conventional sport, and it will be on Vice Sports tomorrow. So I don't want to say more than that because it's not up there yet. Okay. But follow me on Twitter, and I'm sure other people will be nice and tweet it around as well. And then I'm kind of trying to figure out what my baseball writing is going to look like for 2016. You might just have to suffer, you know, by following me on Twitter. Well, we'll have to see. The state of online money for freelancers and online media is not strong. So, but yeah, we'll see. Whenever I think that this gig is up, I always find something else to make it not up. So you have to follow me on Twitter to figure out what's happening.
Fair enough. And you have to follow us on, yeah, exactly. You have to follow us on Twitter too, just so you can get the link to this podcast, which is weird because if you're listening to this anyway. So I'm at Every 6 Day, and Doug.
I am at Moonwalk McFly.
And we, again, the Croncast is on iTunes. It's on Blog Talk Radio. Download us. Give us a review. We are the highest rated podcast in the history of the internet as it stands right now. You could be the one to knock us off that perch or boost our lead because it's a pretty big margin right now. It's up to you. And anyway, in any case, thanks for listening. And Wendy, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for joining us and putting up with us. And nice talking with you.
This was really fun, so I'm begging you to have me back.
Okay. If we're still around, we will definitely be back.